Hello and welcome to the Christmas episode of What We Just Watched. I'm Graham.
And I'm Chris.
Chris, why have you called me here today?
Well, this is the podcast in which two earnest men meet, show each other a couple of old TV shows, and then chat about them.
Okay.
With the added twist that neither of us know what programme the other is about to screen.
I think this will be a lot of fun, and as this is a festive episode, I suggest we play a party game to decide who will go first. Specifically, the post-it note on the forehead game.
My favourite! I happen to have a sheaf of post-it notes right here, so I'm going to secretly write down the name of a favourite Christmas morning TV show for you to guess.
For the listener, Chris is now writing. Again for the listener, Chris is approaching me. Also for the listener, Chris is placing the note on my head. And for the listener, Chris is about to speak.
Right, 10 guesses. Off you go.
Am I on ice?
Yes.
Am I the raccoons on ice?
Yes.
Which means we begin with my offering from the Christmas TV selection box. So, I'm about to show Chris my choice of Christmas viewing. I'll be interested to see how quickly or otherwise you actually get what the show is, because it's a Christmas special, which is no surprise.
Right.
So it means the usual titles
okay,
are gone.
Right.
But let's see how quickly.
Well, we're outside a window. We're zooming into a lovely sort of brightly lit sitting room. I've no idea at this point what the show is. The window's broken quite nicely. We're zooming into the fire.
It's a little chuckle there as the window broke.
Yes. Oh, excellent. So it's Smith and Jones.
Well, is it Smith and Jones?
Oh.
He's just seen them hanging from a tree. Or do you remember the name of this festive special?
Oh, well, I'm going to suggest Alas, Sage and Onion.
Well done. Okay, so we're going to watch Alas, Sage and Onion. We just watched the 1988 Alas, Smith and Jones Christmas special, which was wittily named Alas, Sage and Onion, and it aired on Wednesday 21st of December on BBC Two. So usual question, Chris, did you like it?
I did like it, yes. I have to say, when I realised what the show was going to be, I feared half an hour of hit and miss comedy. Mm. I think when I look back at Smith and Jones now, I really enjoyed it at the time. I kind of feared that it might not have weathered too well, but there was plenty of enjoyable comedy there, and I thought...
If we were putting percentile terms on that, in how much of it worked for you...
I would say 70%.
What did you make of that opening sequence?
Smith and Jones are here again.
That seemed very redolent of an era where to introduce any kind of comedy Christmas show, you would parody a sort of traditional 1950s Christmas show. So they're kind of like in a kind of warmly lit sitting room with Christmas jumpers on. We need to talk a lot about the Christmas jumpers. There's a trio of harmony singers, female harmony singers. Later on, we got a children's choir. That pastiche became the symbol of doing comedy at Christmas. You would parody the kind of Perry Como style of Christmas. Mm.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
The one thing that in my ignorance I was perhaps yearning for to see, which of course was long gone by this point, was the Smith and Jones globe.
That's true. That became very much a kind of hallmark of their early shows.
And the amount of R&D that must have gone into mapping Smith and Jones's head onto the globe.
Do you think there was more? Do you think it was trickier to make Smith and Jones than it was to actually make the world?
Well, yes, because, yeah, let's get into those details. Because you have to have the interior of the globe and the exterior align to form Mel Smith and Griffith Jones's face when it gets to a certain point. So you've got two separate fields here, Chris, moving in 360 degrees.
It feels like we needed a kind of sort of behind-the-scenes feature on Blue Peter or facts, perhaps, to show us how it was done.
Who was that? I've no idea.
Do you have any memory of a Smith & Jones opening skit that wasn't about doing a Smith & Jones opening skit? Did they ever deviate from
that format? I don't think
they
did. Do you think they kind of felt that they kind of wanted to avoid the sort of showbiz cheesiness of a walk-on? Mm. So they perpetually just sent up the cheesiness of the showbiz walk-on.
But it might be so. I also wonder if that was the kind of the writers getting into a groove and that perhaps if they were ever asked to do anything but, they kind of couldn't. But I remember when I always used to like it, that they used to deconstruct that thing. And one of them would normally start very earnestly doing a thing. I suppose it is a bit more kind of wise.
Well, I was about to drop a bombshell here, and we'll say Little and Large used to go down a similar strata.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our Christmas show.
Okay.
Where Sid would come on.
He'd be singing a song, maybe.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to sing you a song.
Yeah. So I'd like to start by singing this lovely Christmas song.
And then obviously Eddie would sort of kind of creep on stage, you know, possibly wearing the deputy dog disguise.
I would like to start this song. What have you got behind your back?
A big fat bum, what have you?
The next item that we see is this kind of Queen's speech thing. Now, I think that's quite interesting because it's shot from the point of view of you are the Queen.
I'm not sure whether they were trying to kind of recapture the magic of the home video sketches.
Because they were, that was mental, wasn't it? My dad loved them.
Yeah, that was the kind of the breakout sketch, the breakout idea, the breakout format from Alice Smith and Jones.
One thing that I thought really hit home about that sketch was how good an actor Griffith Jones is.
Oh, yeah.
That rehearsal, now, it wasn't really your fault, but I'm just trying to tell it, Tom. Okay, fine.
And in particular, he's very, very good at that kind of slightly hostile conviviality, which he's doing.
That's a great phrase.
But he's so good at that kind of politeness.
Yeah. But also, you know, they're doing a sketch about television, so you kind of know that he would have been on the receiving end of that kind of treatment from a floor manager or whatever.
Tonight, would you like to lock him up and throw away the key? Then join some of Fleet Street's finest as they play Bigotry!
The Bigotry Game Show sketch, which is a sketch hosted by Tony Slattery, and there's this idea that he's got together kind of three right-wing columnists or commentators. Yeah. Now, there's a gag about the BBC being full of bisexual social workers, but it's part of that idiom of game show parody, isn't it, where they have tinsel, they have flashing lights. Yeah. Do you think there was a discussion where they decided they're going to stop short of putting Tony Slattery in an actual sequin jacket?
Well, the sequin jacket is always kind of the hallmark of the game show sketch. They probably did sort of that. I imagine that was on a whiteboard somewhere. I wanted to mention that sketch because it was, so this is 1988, and so that sketch is sort of preceded by sort of ident suggesting that this program is on Murdoch vision. So this is very much of an era where quite a lot of comedy was mined out of the notion of what is satellite television going to be like? It's going to be terrible, isn't it?
There's a theme all the way through this of there's a very caustic theme. So there's actually quite a lot of blood and guts across the whole episode, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes they linger on a shot of someone dead.
Well, do you ever mention the kind of, there's a sketch where Griff is out kind of on the moors shooting. And, you know, he kind of bags a catch, doesn't he? But it turns out to be the
Raymond Briggs' snowman. Yes. And the boy as well.
And the boy.
And then the camera just holds, doesn't it, for probably 15 seconds. Yeah. On the snowman's corpse with blood where he's been shot. And there's also a sketch, this kind of, it's a pull back and reveal gag of a policeman briefing about a grisly murder, which they've gone and shot video for because he's got a videotape in the machine showing another corpse covered in blood, and then the gag is it's the police Christmas party. But so there's quite a lot of grit in this show, do you think?
I kind of worry that they kind of felt at this point, or the writers felt at this point, that Mel and Griff, it's BBC Two, you know, they're kind of still at this point alternative comedians. Mm. So we need a bit of, you know, we need a bit of guts, you know, we need to...
Literal guts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is, we need to shock a little bit. And I kind of, you know, if you lost those particular sketches, I don't think you would have lost a great deal.
In a similar kind of caustic, cynical vein, then the next skit where Mel and Griffa in front of the backcloth again doing their bit to an audience is this kind of Morecambe and Wise comedy.
Yeah.
Hello, my little fat friend.
And I suppose, you know, they had previous because they'd done the two Ronnies and the two Ninnies in Not the 9 o'clock News.
We like birds, we're ornithologists, ornithologists. I've got a nice pair of binoculars. You can stick them on your tripod.
Was that an affectionate look at Morecambe and Wise, or was it a critical look at Morecambe and Wise?
I'm not entirely sure it was either. I think kind of there was a bit of affection in Mel's sort of send-up of Eric. The setup is Mel comes on as Eric with the glasses doing all the way business, and Griff is completely nonplussed by this. And
as ever, one of them hasn't been briefed.
Yeah, I think it's not as caustic as the two Ronnies business, but it's quite amusing. I mean, we get the bit where is it the payoff where Mel tries to do Eric's
paper bag
trick, but he has the egg, but he doesn't have the bag.
Do you think at this point, I mean, nowadays there's much more of convergence, isn't there, between two Ronnies, Morecambe Wise, and
absolutely
what people might think of as the alternative? Is this at a point where everyone was a little too self-conscious to allow that convergence? They wanted that demarcation to
go. I think so, definitely. I think we're still at the point where there is a room marked alternative comedians and a room next door marked traditional comedians. Mm. And there was very, very little interaction between them at this point in 1988.
The skits that follows on is the turkey in jail skit.
Yes.
Now, I have to say, I liked this very much, but only for Mel's clucking noises in between.
Father, fortitude, my son, fortitude. Oh, father, I'm innocent, I know.
Which I thought they were wonderful. Did you enjoy? I mean, the premise is that it's a pastor who's visiting someone who's on death row, and it turns out that it's a turkey played by Mel Smith.
Yes.
Your thoughts, please.
I enjoyed it. It goes back to the point I made earlier about kind of how it's their personality and their skill and their warmth that kind of pulls off weaker material. That is one of those kind of classic Christmas writer's room sketches, isn't it? Where they've gone, what happens at Christmas? Well, we have turkey. What could we do with a turkey?
Mm.
Well, you know, I was watching a film the other night about a guy who's on death. Got it. Gold.
Oh, and of course, there is one line in the turkey in jail sketch that resonates now, and I think you could possibly, even though it's referencing something that's long defunct, you could possibly still deploy now in a turkey-related sketch.
Beautiful. What? No.
Do you think there was a discussion, you know, about when they were writing that? Should we do beautiful? Well, that's a bit hackneyed.
But then another end of the room will be saying, "Oh no, you can't not have beautiful." People are going to
People want it
when it lands, and it's done. Yeah, I think it's Griff who has it, isn't it? He slightly throws it away in a nice way, doesn't he?
Yeah,
it's kind of an aside to himself.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
One of the regular franchises, of course, in all of Smith & Jones stuff is the head-to-head.
Yeah, they're very, very good in those sketches, aren't they?
Yeah.
And, you know, right from the start, you know, you've got the setup, and it's a immaculate comedy setup of a dopey guy and an even dopier guy having this conversation.
And that's part of the reason it's so great, isn't it? Because Mel always starts with a fairly sort of lyrical sentiment, which he then... Before he's got to the end of it, he's mangled it.
Another year gone by.
Yeah.
Another year over. And what have you done? Another year over. And a new one beginning.
they got those characters 100% correct straight off the bat, didn't they?
Mm, and who do you think they are? Have you ever stopped to wonder? And also, have you ever stopped to wonder what their physical situation is? Are they lying down? Are they propped up at a bar? Where are they?
It's an interesting point, because I think when I first started watching Smith and Jones and those sketches came on, I think I initially assumed that it was Mel and Griff as themselves, or, to use that terrible kind of modern comedy cliche, heightened versions of themselves.
Mm.
But it's plainly not them, is it? They're two everyman characters. I imagine they're in a pub, a fairly horrible pub. Drink has been taken. They're having that sort of conversation that you sometimes have when drink has been taken, about kind of, you know, in this sketch, Mel starts to sort of panic about, he starts to worry about kind of the passing of time, what he's done with his life. It's a deep conversation done in a shallow way, isn't
it? And it's a late night conversation, isn't it?
I think so.
It's a kind of closing time conversation.
Yeah, I think obviously you get the black backdrop sort of heightens that. But even if that wasn't there, you would get that sensation from what they're saying and the way they're saying it.
I say this not to be willfully provocative. I say this from a genuine sentiment that I find their head-to-head much more successful than Pete and Dud. Because I always think the Pete and Dud thing, that there's an unpleasantness, which is at the core of this. Whereas I think with... And also I think the Griff, Smith and Jones just perform it better than Pete and Dud. So much of the laughs actually come from how... I think they're good scripts anyway.
Yeah.
But the way that they perform those two, the timing and... it's just there's so much more charm.
I think so. I wouldn't argue with that at all. It's very difficult to judge knowing what we know about the Pete and Dud relationship in real life. It's hard to kind of sort of divorce their performances from what we know. But I wouldn't disagree with that that at all.
What about your wife, eh? Yeah. Now is she content with you? Whoa. How can you tell? She hasn't spoken to me for 2 years. 2 years.
One of the quickies in this, which doesn't overstay its welcome and actually works very well, is they have, really apropos of nothing, they have a gag about a big kebab sale.
It's the big Christmas sale at Tony's Kebab House.
There's no joke other than kebabs.
Yes.
They've noticed that kebabs are a thing, and so they've just put that on the screen.
So it's in the same way that today's comics, I think it's a thing that they lean upon less now. Maybe this year is starting to become passé, but Greggs, the mere evocation of a Greggs, used to be a Ginster's before that.
You don't need anything else other than just the reference that you've noticed that it's there, it's a thing. That's it.
You know, Mel... It's funny to think, there's all this changing, hectic world. A little bit of tradition still lingers on, isn't it, you know? I mean, a chance for the family and loved ones to get together around the tree and watch the snow falling outside. And that's what Christmas means to me. Home.
You're off to Lanzarote again, are you?
And this is another sketch where they're wearing Christmas jumpers.
Yes.
Which I'm struggling to pin down where this show comes in the sort of chronology of the Christmas jumper comedy continuum.
Well, does it? I mean,
This might be at the start, but at the time, and for a very long time after this show, the Christmas jumper in a comedy setting was there because it was a sort of thing that nobody in real life would ever wear. And for some bizarre reason, it sort of flipped round and people do wear things like that now because that's what people wore on TV. It's if you actually start to kind of analyse it, it's slightly bizarre.
So you are slightly going out a limb, possibly exposing yourself by saying that you feel this could be the first deployment of a Christmas jumper in this way.
I think I need to delineate here between a colourful patterned jumper,
yes,
which Noel Edmonds might have worn.
Let me stop you there. In what spirit did Noel wear that jumper? Because I think that was just a fashion thing.
I think so, yeah. I don't think there was any kind of attempt to sort of be parodic.
And then it turned into? As he embraced his detractors? And then he wore it, he weaponized the loud jumper.
Yeah, I think so. I think he took ownership of... But what I'm trying to make clear here is a difference between a loud patterned jumper and a specifically patterned Christmas jumper.
Mm.
I'm trying to work out where that might have been first worn. I think if you were going to watch, say, a sitcom from the 1970s, you wouldn't see them, would you?
No, I wonder if at that point it would have been the Santa hat.
Possibly. But certainly, we're talking 1988 here. I think this might be right at the start of the Christmas dinner. But I think it ties into that whole thing about the 1950s Perry Como parody.
Mm. I should say, no spoilers, but in an upcoming episode, Chris and I will discuss the sweatshirt's place in pop culture as well. The penultimate sketch in this programme, but of course also the kind of, what would you call it? It's the hero sketch, isn't it? It's the bravura sketch. It's what it's all leading to.
It's the flagship, isn't it?
The flagship.
Yeah.
I had a very, very strong response, memory, or some kind of reaction that as soon as it cut to film stock, I thought my heart sank.
Yeah.
Because suddenly the pace drops. Yeah. You know it's going to be some sort of epic. You also know that you're going to be, because it's on film, it's going to at least be 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And you're locked into now this thing. And if you don't, you're not immediately grabbed by that, it's got nowhere else to go. And this idea is it's a Martin Scorsese take on The Birth of Christ.
Again, it's one of those writer's room sketches where kind of it's Christmas.
Yeah.
Something about the birth of Christ. What new twist can we put on this? Oh, well, so this is presumably not long after the last temptation of Christ. Mm. So, and film parodies in general, I don't like for all the reasons you outlined.
I think also with Smith and Jones, I broadly like to see them being Smith and Jones, you know, albeit.
Yeah.
You know, Smith is a vicar, or you know, Jones is a policeman, but they are still broadly Smith and Jones. So when they have to be subsumed into a parody like this.
Yeah, I think film parodies are very, very difficult to pull off because you've kind of got to have the same sort of structure as a film with a start, middle, and an ending. But you've kind of got to be funny at the same time. The film sort of sucks any energy. Because you know there's no reaction, there's no laughter when they're performing it. So there's a sort of mismatch between their delivery and the reaction of the audience. And there's just kind of as you say, a complete drop in pace. And you know there are jokes that don't really land. But you need to have them because they're kind of sort of that line is particularly key to the plot in inverted commas. I wasn't at the time and still am not a massive fan of the kind of sort of the lavish film parody.
And I think also, you know, when in terms of that, you know, this sketch is going to stick around for a while because it's telling a certain story.
Yeah.
You sort of know where you are along the way in the retelling of that story.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh shit, you know, Mary hasn't even had the baby yet and we've already had 3 minutes and we still got to go through that. There's still got to be the bit with the shepherds and the three wise men.
Yes.
And so all these, it just turns into a lot of kind of admin that you've got to get through. The last item has, it's kind of restaging the opening item, isn't it? With this sort of, this almost Dickensian, but 40s-esque front room.
Holy night.
Well, that's nearly the end for us. For you, I'm afraid, it's only just beginning.
I found that very charming because I think this was a bit where I felt that sort of, you know, we talked earlier, didn't we, about the slight sort of cynicism within the show.
And
it's very nicely done here because we have Mel and Griff who are it's taking to their chairs amongst these school kids who are singing songs. And as they do it, they don't make a big play of it, but they're sort of pushing kids' heads out the way so they can sit down.
Yeah.
And then as they're conversing, they're clearly annoyed that they're having to kind of talk over these
Well, it's kind of quite a nice joke about kind of like how they can't quite hear each other over the kind of the children singing.
Yeah, and Mel lights his cigar off a candle that's held by kind of one of the choristers.
Yeah.
So I liked all that. I wasn't so sure about the gag in that Mel recounting his Christmas Day, which is sort of getting hammered.
Yeah, I'll get up about 11 o'clock, a couple of gin and tonics at home, you know, then I'll nip off the boozer as soon as it opens. 8 or 9 pints there, I should imagine, watching the show.
Although I did like this evocation of a stripper.
Very good stripper on a Christmas Day. Comes on just wearing a sprig of holly. Very good finale, too. She pours brandy over her head and then sets fire to herself.
Well, it would be now too tawdry a thing to have on the Christmas Day show.
I think so. It was kind of quite archaic to have reference to the pub closing in the afternoon and then he went home and he went back to the pub when it opened again in the evening. Mm. That seems very much of its era.
Mm. Do you feel that the comedy Christmas special tends to be the best exponent of that comedy show? Or do you feel the Christmas special is that show, but maybe not as good in general?
I think probably the latter. Mm. I think if you're going to analyse it, I think you would probably say that they're kind of not an example of a particular act or a particular artiste at the top of their game. I think because there are so many sort of it's a minefield to be negotiated, isn't it? The Christmas comedy special, because Christmas has just kind of a limited sort of catalogue of subjects. There are only so many spins you can put on these things.
Mm.
But if you don't include those things, it's just a regular version of the show, isn't it? It's such a difficult minefield to navigate.
And lastly, in opening up this episode, we had a slight back and forth about how we were going to decide who went first, etc.
Yes.
Are you now angry? Do you now feel that we missed a trick and that we should have done one where you've come along and you're all game and gung-ho for opening up this, what we just
Absolutely.
Watched? And I come in and perhaps, what, I'm in my pyjamas for some reason, I've been drinking, and maybe I'm rowdy or leery.
I think so. We definitely missed a trick there. Can we go back and record that again? So that was Alas, Sage and Onion, first broadcast in 1988. And now it's time for my Christmas selection.
OK, so we're about to watch Christmas selection for me. And so you've explained there isn't a title sequence per se.
Not as such, no.
So there won't be a kind of a penny drop.
There will be a penny drop.
There will.
Yeah.
OK. OK, so we're looking at an ordinary house. And is that a postman who's arriving? There's a Christmas bouquet on the door. Is that Cheggers? Oh, it's not a postman. Is he a funeral cortege? Norris McWirt. Okay. So Norris McWirt has emerged, which must mean that we're looking at an all-star record breaker.
We very much are looking at an all-star record breaker.
Now, this is... let's stay with this for a moment.
Okay.
So Cheggers actually is Norris's chauffeur.
Yes.
And Norris is now in the back of a car where there is soothing music playing and Cheggers has...
but what is the soothing music, Graham?
What is that?
I think it might kick in now. Okay.
Saturday Superstore.
Superstore.
Okay.
So we're watching the 1982 All-Star Record Breakers in association with Saturday Superstore.
And I think on that point, we shall gently fade out and leave us to enjoy this and we'll report back afterwards.
So we just watched the All-Star Record Breakers, first broadcast on BBC One at 4:30 on 26th of December 1982. And I'm legally obliged to point out here that it wasn't officially Boxing Day because it fell on a Sunday. So it was, of course, Christmas Sunday. So also on Record Breakers then, it was the annual festive edition of Record Breakers where they'd bring all the presenters and all stars of BBC children's programmes together in a sort of lavish musical extravaganza based around a particular theme.
Do you think it doubled up as their office party?
I imagine that on every presenter's calendar there was a big red circle around the recording date for All-Star Record Breakers. Mm. So I should point out that this was done in association with Saturday Superstore.
You need to find a place where you can make some friends. Get out a little more and pick up the latest trends.
It was a party set within Saturday Superstore.
Mm.
I think very excitingly, we actually got to see the exterior of the Superstore, which I think is the only time that ever happened.
Also, I wondered about, because we visited some departments, which I'm not sure are canon. I don't know, did they have a music department?
I don't really recall. I don't really recall seeing the music department on Saturday Superstore, but we did get to see the sports department, didn't we?
We did, manned by David Icke.
Mm.
Hello, Sarah, how are you doing?
Hello, David. I'm just looking rather enviously at some of that diving gear you've got there.
Because you do a lot of that diving, don't you?
Now, how did you feel about David Icke's role in proceedings? Because he didn't really join in with the singing and dancing. Do you think there was a phone call that he said, I'm quite happy to be there. I'm quite happy to share my face. I don't really feel it's me to be singing and dancing.
Well, I think that the whole production kind of, you can almost whiff the negotiations that went on behind the
Absolutely.
Scenes.
Absolutely.
So Paul McDowell is given one singing line, isn't
yes.
he?
Yes.
In the Navy, yes, you can sail the seven seas.
I recall as we were watching it, you said, oh, bless you, Paul.
Tony Hart appears, but he will only appear in a pre-recorded segment.
Within his Take Heart
yep.
studio.
Yeah.
He wanted to show his face.
Mm.
He wanted to put his stamp on proceedings, but yeah, that was it. He wasn't going to be singing and
That's
dancing.
Maggie Philbin takes part in what could be termed as a duet with Keith, but as they are both, for reasons we won't go into, dressed up as sheep, while he sings, all she contributes is sort of bar
yeah,
noises.
Yeah.
Black sheep, tell me do.
It's one of those performances where it looks like she's contributing just enough to kind of be half of the presence on stage, but Keith is doing the heavy lifting, isn't he?
And do you think anyone appears under sufferance, or do you think they all want to be part of this happening?
I think by this stage they probably want to be there.
Because you're nobody if you're not an all-star. In terms of the BBC Children's Department.
Well, the clue is in the name of the all-star record breakers. You know, if you're not one of the all-stars, then you're no stars. So, Graham, for you, who were the standout performers?
Gosh, that's a good question. Who were this? Well, actually, I mean, there's nothing original in what I'm about to say, but Roy Castle. He does a song about the San Francisco disco dancing.
Yeah.
What is it?
San Francisco Disco Dancing School.
Which he decides to do in the style of George Formby.
At the San Francisco Disco Dancing School, they taught you to apply the golden rule.
But there is a fact that when he gets up and starts doing his thing,
yeah.
you suddenly feel you're in very safe hands.
I know.
Because he's a man who can work the room,
yeah.
can bring characterisation to a song, and does it with a lot of confidence.
It's very difficult to talk about Roy Castle without lapsing into cliche, even at the time and in the years since. You know, kind of Roy Castle is sort of almost slightly dismissed as, oh, Mr. Versatile.
Mm, mm.
You know, he's always, you know, quite willing to kind of, you know, get on the trumpet and bash out a tune. But actually, he's really, really good, isn't he?
He's great.
He is great.
I think Peter Duncan does very well. And he has a whole sequence where we see him appearing in lots of different costumes. Inevitably, his green and white check suit
absolutely.
Makes an appearance.
Absolutely.
Because people are going to want to see that, aren't they?
I think so. I think so. I was going to make the analogy that if this is Live Aid, then Peter Duncan is Freddie Mercury.
Yes.
He really seizes it.
Yes.
He really grabs the ball by the horns. We do see the green and white suit because there's a musical number which is based around a dedicated follower of fashion.
Yes, yeah.
Which segues beautifully into Roy's.
Dedication's what you need. If you want to be a neat, a beat, a punk and Duncan, record breaker.
I didn't see that coming.
Same here.
Yeah.
Same here.
And then conversely, I think there are a couple of... No, I was going to say a couple of people at the side down. There's one person, which is Norris McWhirter, who the opening sequence then has Cheggers going to pick him up at his home.
Yes.
And take him in a chauffeur.
Yeah, and kind of it's the world's most expensive Rolls Royce.
Well, already Norris is having this very joyless conversation where he's kind of drilling Cheggers on stats about the car.
Details.
What is this? Well, this is a Rolls Royce Phantom 6, sir.
Details?
Well, it's actually powered by a 6.5-litre engine. Has a top speed of 115 miles per hour.
And Cheggers tells them that it costs twice the amount of a standard Rolls-Royce, as if that knowledge will have any impact on any child watching.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't give Norris a lot to do anyway.
Which is fortunate, really.
But when he comes in, he really kind of takes the wind out of the proceedings.
Yeah. There's a sequence where John Craven is noodling around the toy department.
Yes.
And marvelling at these amazing technological toys because it's 1982 and there's kind of weird electronic games. There's one electronic game which I didn't kind of recognise, but which had apparently been a star bargain on Saturday Superstore. But then Norris comes in and sort of assails him with the world's most expensive toy soldier.
Did you know that a single toy soldier made in 1910 was sold at auction in London in 1981 for £260?
Wow.
And this is the whole idiom of what Norris does, that people are having a good time and suddenly he comes in with his slightly nerdy voice.
Yes.
And actually, do you know? And everyone's...
It's kind of on Record Breakers, that was kind of... Now we come to the part of the programme where, you know, Norris is going to kind of answer your questions. But he's not going to really answer the questions. He's just going to deliver a fact, which may or may not be tangentially related to the question you're asking about the world's biggest leaf or whatever it was.
Why do you think that this year they decided to kind of do a fusion of shows? Why was Superstore thrown in the mix? And also, where is Mike Reed standing in this? Because he seems to be hosting, but he's actually just listed alphabetically at the end.
I wonder about that. I wonder what Mike's agent thought when the credits went up and Mike's there between Maggie Philbin and...
Well, more what did Roy Castle think? That suddenly he's... Because they're moving the whole Record Breakers team and they're all going round to Mike's place.
Absolutely. But I don't think there's any kind of... there's no on-screen malice or, Roy's happy to be there.
Roy's very fastidious about thanking Mike for having him.
Absolutely. I think in terms of why they... I mean, Saturday Superstore had sort of launched about 3 months earlier.
Okay.
I think this was kind of a tricky manoeuvre for the BBC, given that Swap Shop had ended after 6 years... Saturday Superstore had replaced it, albeit it's just the same show, but with Mike Reed in a fictional superstore.
Mm.
But I think they kind of felt maybe this is something to give it an additional lift. After 3 months, this is an opportunity for people to come in and sample the whole superstore experience.
And maybe it shows that it's part of... It is part of that firmament that Roy has inhabited for years.
Yeah.
And it gives it a kind of validity.
Yeah.
It gives it a sort of a stature.
It kind of puts it in... It kind of says, this is part of the same family as Blue Peter and Cracker Jack and Grange Hill. Mm. We need to talk about Grange Hill, actually,
well,
don't we?
Yes.
We were lounging round the school just the other day, chewing on some sticks of gum.
There's a breakout sketch, which is Precious Matthews and Gripper Stebson capering around the corridors with Johnny Ball as a teacher.
He said, "I hate to disturb you. I mean, I know you're feeling high, but there's a cloud on the horizon. No word of a lie, so get a grip on yourself. Pen or pen, examinations have come round again."
And there are so many things that disturb me about this, because Johnny is wearing a mortarboard. He's sort of he's very much a kind of a Bass Street Kids teacher.
Absolutely. And he is the antithesis of what Grange Hill was about. I'm kind of wondering what Phil Redmond would have made about this treatment of his franchise.
At the height of their race war, you have Gripper and Precious.
Absolutely.
Alone in the school together.
So we get Gripper Stebson, who is, without doubt, I think, still the most sort of malevolent character ever to appear on children's television.
Mm.
And he's doing a musical number.
The other thing that I always find, I remember at the time, it still slightly bothers me now, is this is going to sound very prejudiced. I don't think the Play School presenters are on an even footing, and I don't think they should be accepted as peers by the likes of Blue Peter, Record Breakers, Superstore, the Newsround team. I feel Play School presenters, they have a very different place within that whole kind of family.
I get what you're saying, because I think watching this show for the first time in 34 years, I felt slightly inadequate in that I didn't know who they all were.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the people I didn't know were sort of latter-day Play School presenters.
Yeah.
I would make an exception for Floella Benjamin.
Yes.
Who, you know, performs with great gusto,
yes,
as you would expect,
yes,
from,
yeah,
from Baroness Benjamin.
Mm. I've seen lots of funny things in my time, but there's one thing that I've not seen up to now.
Ben Thomas.
Who's great.
Who's fantastic.
Yeah,
he takes the lead on, they do a rendition of In the Navy.
Mm. If you like adventure, don't you wait to enter. Call your recruiting office fast.
And he's really great. He's really giving it his all.
Mm.
Signing up a seaman fast.
This show, coming from 1982, sort of really sort of capitalizes and obsesses about two of the great happenings of 1982, and they are the raising of the Mary Rose.
Oh, my God. Was 82 the year of the raising of the Mary Rose?
It certainly was, yes.
And I was angry with Sarah because they're doing In the Navy, which she then dragoons into just, you know, about the fucking Mary Rose again, as if we haven't had enough of it all year.
And
they broke into regular programming to show the Mary Rose coming up. She starts suddenly, you know, wondering what would it be like to have been on board.
Must have been amazing to be able to see the Mary Rose when Henry VIII was alive, though, eh?
You know, let it go now.
You obviously feel very strongly.
I'm very angry about that, yeah.
And we also get quite a lot of fame, don't we? We get we get almost the entire cast in sort of, you know, kind of leotards. And
which, I don't want to see Jonathan Cohen demeaned in that way. I don't want to see Johnny Ball wearing a sweatband.
Well,
you happy now?
No.
They're very keen to be all over the latest happening, mm-hmm, but at the same time, they're throwing in these kind of out of copyright standard 1930s songs.
Never wronged an onion. I hope I never shall.
Which, yeah, you know, it's get this idea of that they're putting together a show, so they're leafing through these old books,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
old routines that they can just perform.
And a lot of them feel slightly crowbarred in,
yeah,
don't they? I mean, the first number in the entire show is Delia Morgan from Play School.
Mm.
You know, we had to look her up.
Mm.
And she's doing,
I'm looking for a guy who plays trumpet, slide trombone and doubles on a bass guitar and wears a size 37 suit.
That's quite an underwhelming start to the show, isn't it? Yeah.
And all of these would have been on kind of novelty records from a long, long time ago.
I think you're kind of sort of tapping into kind of one of the sort of questions I wanted to ask you about, Graham, is kind of, would this have entertained you at the time?
Mm.
Would you have watched it with kind of an amount of glee? Or would you, or is it something that you would have watched because it was on and contained all your favourite stars from children's programmes?
I think it's the latter. I think it's this, it's a busy show.
Yeah.
There are lots of setups.
Yeah.
And I think you watch more because, you know, I've never seen Paul McDowell in that context. It's that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
That's
the attraction, really, isn't,
yes,
it?
Yeah. I've never seen Simon Groom dressed up as a big baby.
We do everything alike. We look alike, we dress alike, we walk alike, we talk alike, and what is more, we hate each other very much.
Well, I think we need to talk about the Blue Peter team's performance here. It is, of course, the Imperial Phase Blue Peter team of Simon, Peter and Sarah.
Yeah.
I think it's quite significant that they get their own routine,
yes,
separated from the rest of the cast.
Well, it's a maturer brand, isn't it? And they demand some deference.
I think so.
So remind me then. So Sarah was doing Blue Peter in the week and Superstore at the weekend.
Not at this point. She was still solely on Blue Peter at this point.
So do you think she caught Mike Reed's ear sort of during this party and said, look, Mike, I'm thinking of moving on.
I think that's a distinct possibility because she left Blue Peter about 6 months after this show went out.
Happy Christmas! Happy Christmas!
Something that I noticed in this, because there's part of the joys is you feel you're getting a snapshot on how these people talk to each other.
Yeah.
So there's lots of scenes where they're in, what do they call the basement? Is it the cafe?
I think it's the coffee bar.
The coffee bar.
I want to point out, actually, that kind of one of the great strengths of this show, I think, is the kind of the way they kind of attend to the reality of the situation. Mm. You get Mike detailing John Craven to take round some sandwiches Maggie Philbin takes some cheese straws round.
Mm. And I like it that whenever we kind of cut in on some chat, and because they're all very ebullient and excited to be there, the first word you hear is, hey.
Hey, did you know the longest-lived triplets of all time were the Coughlins who lived in America?
Hey.
Hey, this look over here, and hey, I've just got this thing. And it was, at that time, that was the way to signal, wasn't it? That, hey, here's something that's about to happen.
It's kind of a relation of the oh hello style of introduction to the TV show, which you got quite a lot at that time, where we would join the presenter in the middle of something and they would just look up and go, oh hello,
as if I'd be doing this anyway. But as you're here, I'll clue you in on what's going on.
Yes,
couldn't you talk me through, please, the there is a sequence which is Jonathan Cohen, who is one of the gentlemen who I thought was Peter Egan, but isn't.
Sadly, it wasn't Peter Egan. I think it's Ben Bazell from Play School.
Ben Bazell, and then Roy, and they're...
And there's someone else who we still don't know who she was. She was playing the violin.
And they perform Feelings.
They perform an instrumental version of Feelings. I think this was kind of very much a hallmark of All-Star Record Breakers, in which, amidst all the gaiety and the frivolity, there would be a sequence where they would show off... It's a bit like Mike Yarwood saying, and this is me. So it's very much, and this is us performing kind of quite po-faced, a musical number. And it kind of, you're kind of wondering at a distance of three decades what you know, a seven-year-old, eight-year-old kid would have made of that.
Because it's like a showcase for musicality.
It's funny you should use the word showcase because it feels like something that would have appeared on their show reel, as if to say, "Well, I'm not just about Wild Track. There are other strings to my bow." I think we need to talk about the Guinness Book of Records and its role within the proceedings of this. Edition, because it seems to fade into the background. I think kind of when people talk about the All-Star Record Breakers, they think of 1977, the dancers tap dancing around the fountain at Television Centre.
Inchworm. Noel Edmonds. That's from that year, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's not kind of a record, is it?
No. Okay. No. That's what I think of.
Yeah. But here, the kind of the Guinness Book of Records seems to have been sort of pushed into the background a bit by Mike Reed, I would venture to suggest.
Well, and actually, this is another thing with Norris, that when he, I suppose, bless him, he's trying to steer it back onto that remit. And actually, it feels that everything else about that format is resistant to this kind of chat about stats and biggest and most expensive.
Yeah.
And it has no place there. And I think maybe this format is a... It's a muddy format, isn't it?
I think so. I think at this point in time, the Guinness Book of Records was still a thing in a way that it kind of isn't now. People used to kind of sort of go, you should be in the Guinness Book of Records, you.
Yes, it's not totemic anymore. In the way that it once was. Do you blame Chris Akabusu?
I think he should definitely be tried.
Mm.
I think he should have his day in the dock for the diminution of the Guinness Book of Records, absolutely. So, Graham, can I ask you, where would this have stood within the TV year for you? Is it something you would have actively searched out in the Christmas Radio Times?
Yes. Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of one of these things that you, by this point in my life, you feel is, it's not just a TV show, it's an entitlement.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is for me. This has to happen. I'm not sure I have memories, though, of watching this one. You know, at the time, all of that seemed, you know, pretty new to me. I feel slightly resentful of where it has gone in this episode,
yeah,
because it never came back after this.
This is the last one.
And possibly Mike Reed is the reason for that. Not that, I mean, I actually would have welcomed, you know, the continuation of a kind of the Saturday Superstore Christmas party, because it's reason enough to have everyone come together.
Yeah, and that is the key to the whole thing, isn't it? Seeing all these people together.
Roy is kind of a guest on his own show.
Yeah.
Even though he still gets top billing.
Absolutely.
There's a very poignant scene at the end, isn't there, where actually we stay with Mike.
Yeah.
Who has been our de facto host, our literal host, and we see him
turning off the lights in the store,
and he is minding the store. In his
official capacity as store manager. It's still, at this point, it was a big deal. I think for the programs and the people involved. I think it's very much the thing that they would have excitedly trailed on the last Blue Peter before Christmas.
We've got news of something else that we've been up to.
Yep, we've all been taking part in Roy Castle's All-Star Record Breakers, and as usual, we have been dressing up.
And without a shadow of a doubt, you'll see us as you've never seen us before. We're in nappies.
It's quite interesting to see where this show sort of lies in the chronology of children's TV and the era, because 8 days after the show went out, children's TV sort of changed forever, because suddenly we had children's ITV.
On Hold Tight, there's Ralph McTell, Buster Blood Vessel and Roman Holiday.
As a coherent brand, which had never happened before. And I think prior to that point in time, the BBC had sort of been seen perennially as the market leader, as it were. And I think All-Star Record Breakers was sort of very much a part of that, because you saw all the presenters together. It made the BBC's children's offering look like one coherent whole, which ITV had never really done. But very soon after the show went out, they put a lot more effort into a brand and a coherent scheduling. So do you think this could possibly be seen as kind of the end of an era for children's TV?
It might be. Well, it's certainly a change. And actually, I think it's interesting you say that, because maybe one of the appeals of All-Star Record Breakers was that kind of that idea that they all exist in the same universe, which wasn't happening. But then when children's BBC came along, when children's ITV came along, that kind of formalised this idea that actually we're a unit, which was only ever a thing that you got in passing. And I suppose Blue Peter would kind of make contact with other shows from time to time.
Yeah.
But All-Star Record Breakers was only the only real evidence, the idea that they're all in the same building. And then maybe that's why All-Star Record Breakers didn't come back after this, because you didn't need that anymore.
Sure.
Well, we're at the end of our own kind of TV cream version of an All-Star Record Breakers, except
I think we are.
This is what we do all the time, which has come together in this exciting way to talk about programmes. But we've talked about two Christmas editions. All-Star Record Breakers wouldn't exist if there weren't Christmas editions. Whereas
True.
Smith & Jones, of course, did exist, and
then
they have to lay on a Christmas edition. So do you think maybe All-Star is the vehicle that really engages and captures Christmas?
I think it does, although it's kind of interesting that there is very little Christmassy in the show, whereas there's a lot more Christmas in Smith & Jones' show.
Do you think maybe it's implicit in All-Star in that there is the entertainment style is kind of knockabout, pantomimey, variety, old school.
Yeah. It's festive, isn't it? It's festive television. Even though there's very little tinsel and no mince pies, it's still festive fare for Christmas Sunday.
You've been listening to the Christmas edition of What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched Alas, Sage and Onion from the 21st of December 1988.
And All-Star Record Breakers from the 26th of December 1982.
Goodbye and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.